Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a homeowner nightmare after squatters move in and refuse to leave. We talk to the property owner and a real estate attorney about the state of anti-squatting laws and what's about to change. Later in the program, a local performance of The Color Purple by the city's oldest African-American theater company in Jacksonville. But first, if someone breaks into your house and begins sleeping there, you might think that they're subject to arrest. But that's not always the case. I'm joined now by a Jacksonville homeowner who found out the hard way. Hello, Patty Peoples.
Hello, Ann.
And we're also joined by Zach Roth, an attorney with Ansbacher Law, which specializes in real estate law, and we should note also is a station underwriter. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, have you experienced any issues with squatters, or do you have any questions about the law? You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and you can reach out on social media, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, or X. Patty Peoples, your story has recently got a lot of attention, not just nationally, but of state lawmakers. But last March, this ordeal was just beginning for you. So for people who may not be familiar with what happened, take us back to the beginning.
Well, this has been 12 months of probably the most frustrating, surprising, infuriating, and eventually satisfying experience that I've ever had in my life. About 1 year ago today, I had a house up for sale in an adjacent to the neighborhood I live, which is Springfield. I'd sent a handyman over to do some last minute changes because I had accepted an offer on the home. And a pit bull mother and 14 babies were discovered on the front porch. When I went over there to see what was going on, out walked two women and their toddlers who told me that they had a lease. Well, as the homeowner, I said, well, the property is absolutely not for sale, and I'm sorry, but you're going to have to leave. I've sold this house. And she immediately launched into an incredibly detailed description of who had leased the house. She pulled up a lease on her phone. She had a receipt showing what she had paid. And when the police arrived, they took her story. They took my story. He did a little bit of research, and then he called me over and delivered the most frightening information you never want to hear from a police officer, which is, I can do nothing for you. This is clearly a serial squatter, but as a representative of the criminal court system, I cannot help you. You have to take this through civil court because she is considered a lawful tenant until you prove that she isn't.
I want to ask, you know, she presented this lease and a sort of, you know, maybe convincing spiel. Were you persuaded that she perhaps had been scammed into thinking that she was the rightful tenant, or did you not believe her story from the start?
It's a great question, Ann. Absolutely. My first emotion was empathy. Here was two young women with two, three or four year old children. And I sat there and had a very empathic conversation with her. I'm so sorry that you are going to have to find another place to live, and I'd be happy to try to help you do that. And so, yes, I had heard that there are many examples where people pose as landlords or homeowners and rent the house out. It's really, really common down in South Florida, and I thought perhaps someone had done that. And I thought this will just be a simple situation. Maybe we can get her into some temporary shelter for the night and I can get my house back. But that was not the case. Immediately when the police officer started querying her, she started getting really aggressive and defensive.
And Zach, this circumstance, I mean, I think we have, as Patty says, all kind of heard of the fake rental scam where somebody rents you an Airbnb or somebody rents you an apartment or even tries to sell you a home. And they're not the rightful owner. And so people get scammed out of their deposits. But how common is what she's talking about, which is where somebody is a tenant, pretending to be a tenant, and actually has kind of created a fake series of documents?
Unfortunately, I think it's actually pretty common. We encounter it quite a bit. We have people coming and saying a similar situation to Patty's, that I've got this home for sale. I've got a closing in 30 days. And I have somebody who has no right to be in the property who's living there. Please help me. And historically, the law has been fairly limited, especially in a quick recourse. because you had to go through the court system and file a civil action to remove the person, which takes time. You have to serve process on somebody who you don't even know who they are because they just moved into your house. They're not a tenant. And then you have to go through and get default and then get the judge to agree that you're right and have a judgment on your unlawful detainer action. And then what often happens at the time that the writ of possession is issued by the court telling the sheriff to go put the person back into possession is they will then file something at the last minute to try to kick the can even further because these people are serial squatters. They're professionals at what they're doing, and they know the tricks of the trade, so to speak.
What about this is not just breaking and entering? I mean, if somebody goes into your house, they let themselves in, that's a criminal violation. Why is this different?
I'm not sure that it is different, except that the police and the state's attorney have to prove that. And when these people are showing these fabricated leases, that's placing a lot of burden on the sheriff to say, now I'm having to decide who I believe right now on the spot. And that's just a very difficult situation that they've been left in historically, and they've deferred to the civil courts to make that decision.
Right. And I guess there's a lot of circumstances we don't want police officers making legal decisions. You know, there could be custody issues that they're asked to make a decision on. We do typically defer to the civil courts to handle those kinds of things. But Patty, as you learned, that can be really time consuming and damage can be done in the process.
Absolutely. Essentially, what this means is that until your case meanders through the civil court system, and that can take weeks to months, and in some states, years. But here in Florida, here in Duval County, we have to expect that that's going to be multiple weeks. And what that means from the homeowner's perspective is that those squatters, considered tenants until shown differently in civil court, have the right to privacy on the property. And I, as the rightful homeowner, have absolutely no rights. I cannot step foot on that property without their permission. And there was an occasion where I went to the property, the front door was open, and I thought they had vacated. So I walked up and put a foot into the house. And at that point, they came out from the back of the house and they assaulted me. When the police came, the police officer told me in no uncertain terms that if I stepped foot on that property again, I would be the one arrested. And you saw this happen probably on the national news in New York, where a rightful homeowner was arrested when she changed the locks on the squatter. Until it meanders through the civil court system now, not after our new bill, but now, then you don't have any rights in your own property.
And I want to get to that, the change in the bill in a little bit, but you confronted the squatters on your property. Mm-hmm. And I think that you maybe now have a different view of whether that was wise. Mm-hmm. You reference a case in New York where a property owner was arrested, but in fact, a property owner was recently killed, mm-hmm. Coming upon squatters in her mother's vacant apartment. Mm-hmm. And there's a murder case now pending against the two people that were living there. What would you advise someone to do or not do based on your experience?
I tell you, it's really playing with fire if you confront these squatters. And of course, my attorney and my family members suggested for me not to. Generally, I really kept my distance. But I have to say that it's just human emotion when you're in the midst of this. There is nothing that feels more unfair that you cannot have access to your biggest investment in your life because of some antiquated law. And so I acted impulsively and very dangerously. And so if anyone out there is dealing with this, please stay on the right side of the law and respect the boundaries, because you really are placing yourself at risk. There are some services out there that try to outsquat the squatters or use the existing laws to the homeowner's advantage. But I think all of those promote vigilante justice, which I think is one of the biggest advantages of Florida passing a squatter bill, is that it will reduce the risk of vigilante justice.
We're talking about squatters and property and changes to the law that have resulted in large part because of our guests' experience with squatters. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We have a call Mark on the South Side. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning. Your guest kind of just touched on, I guess, the purpose of my call, and that was, are there things that a homeowner can do outside of civil court to basically make the squatters want to leave? This has been a topic in the news over the past couple of months, and I've heard instances where legitimate homeowners have written a new legal lease to someone and then let them move into the house, in essence causing the squatters to have to share with somebody. But I'm ignorant to the legalities of that, but I have heard that used some, and I understand the safety concerns that you have with that, but I just kind of wonder, are there ways that you could, in essence, make life so quote-unquote unpleasant for the squatters that they say, hey, this just didn't worth it for us?
Zach, I'm going to ask you to answer that question and also to consider, you know, is there any ability for a homeowner, for instance, to take out a restraining order against the squatter or some order of protection that would prevent them from being on their property?
Yeah, so as to the caller's question, I guess you could enter into this other lease concept and bring new tenants in, but if essentially what you're doing is sending in a proxy to have your fight for you at that point, and to truly get rid of the squatter, if they refuse to leave, you're still going to have to go to civil court. So under the law that exists until July 1st, there's not a lot, I think, that you can practically do to truly get rid of them. You can try different things, but at the end of the day, they're professional criminals. They're going to do what professional criminals do. And so they're probably not going to be dissuaded by ideas like legitimate leases and that kind of thing. In terms of the restraining order, you know, a violence injunction, that type of thing, the law is pretty specific on what you have to have for that. And just trespass alone typically isn't sufficient. So, unfortunately, without some real threats of violence or acts of violence or something like that, that's also probably not a route that's available.
We have a call from another Patty in St. Augustine. Good morning, Patty. Go ahead. Are you there, Patty?
I am. I'm sorry. Can you hear me? I don't know if it's echoing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. If you have a family member that, say, you purchased a home for, say, elderly parents, and then you have them allowing another relative and their significant other to move in, but it used to be the invited guest scenario, that once they were there 14 days, they became, I guess, they had some type of tenancy rights. What happens if you're the homeowner and you do not want those other invited guests to be there? Are you allowed to use the squatter's rights to remove those individuals?
Good question, Patty. Zach, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, so I don't think the new law would change this answer, and short answer, no. You can't use the squatter law to do that. Now, the situation we're talking about is essentially where someone enters with permission, and then that permission is subsequently revoked. So the cause of action that you'd use there is an unlawful detainer, which is very similar to an eviction, except eviction is for someone who has a lease agreement, who has a written document, or
I think she's talking more though, like if she owns the house and her elderly parents allow this, you know, these other people to live there, does she have any recourse?
Right. It's essentially a sublease situation. And so it flows down. So you would have to seek the unlawful detainer action, potentially even against the parent as well, to say anyone claiming through you. But I think you would still have a cause of action to those third parties, because you could say, our agreement for you to live in this property was that you could live in this property, but not other people. And then you could assert the right because they entered with permission. You as a property owner have revoked that permission and you could seek to remove that person.
Patty, I'm sure you explored a lot of options during this, 40 days before they were eventually evicted?
Well, I explored all the options that I knew about, which a year ago, this was not really in the news at all. And I called a dozen attorneys before I discovered one that had some experience in squatters' rights and in property owners' rights. The internet as a source of information was a morass of different state laws, and I didn't have the skill set to deduce what to do with that. So really, I think squatters or homeowners, when they have squatters, are left in most states without any recourse. They don't know how to navigate the civil court system. It's slow. And meanwhile, someone is living in their home. And realize, this doesn't necessarily have to be a rental home or a vacation home. There, we have examples right here in Duval County and in St. Johns County where individuals have gone away for a vacation and their primary residence and come home and there are squatters sitting on their couch and they are unable to enter the home. This happened right down in Ponte Vedra a year ago. So it is just a nonsensical law that I think we're going to get a little bit of relief for. But I do want to make one plea out there is that we don't really have a very good understanding of how prevalent squatter issues are. There is no organization that tracks this. There's no organization that tries to differentiate evictions and other things for in terms of causality. And so I think as states are knowing that this is a much greater problem every month, we need to have much better data to track the efficacy of laws.
We have a call, Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just got a couple of objections to this law. Number one, somewhere in there I read or heard that there was a stipulation about jail time for squatters. The criminal justice system is overloaded as it is now. The jails are crowded. There's been lots of discussion about this in Duval County especially. And if this law ends up incarcerating a bunch of people, then it's being counterproductive. Secondly, and this is a sort of more general point, we're not addressing the root problem here. I mean, this provides relief for the people whose homes have been violated or entered or what have you or occupied. But what are we going to do with all these growing number of homeless people? I mean, that's the real problem here. And we keep kicking the can down the road. Ron DeSantis is war on poor people, I don't think is going to work out the way he envisions. If all these people living in these encampments turn into a mob, then, you know, then what? So anyway, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Eric. Patty, you're shaking your head.
Well, I think that that's a really important point to raise is what or who are squatters? And that was always my concern when I waded into this battle is that I was fearful that any sort of squatter law could be used as a cudgel against undocumented immigrants and our unhoused population. And to be truthful, I think since this has really been picked up by the right side of our politics, that it kind of is going to be used as a cudgel. However, my experience and the experience of many people that have dealt with squatters, and this is only anecdotal, is that most of these squatters are not, in fact, unhoused individuals or undocumented immigrants into our country. What they are people that have studied this system and are taking advantage of it. They are knowledgeable. They typically, as Zach mentioned, work in squatter rings. There are groups on Reddit and Facebook and YouTube and everywhere that teach people how to squat. And if you follow those groups like I do, you will see that their intent is really to take something from people that they feel have too much.
And Patty, describe for us, I mean, when the tenants, the squatters left your house, there was significant damage. Tell us a little bit about what you found when they left. And was that something that was occurring while they were living there? Or was that just kind of their farewell salvo?
Well, over the course of the 36 days they were in my property, they started slowly denigrating it. I mean, there was trash everywhere. They were having parties and leaving food all out in the yard, and they were really becoming an eyesore for this lovely little street. And then I began to notice that windows were being broken, and I could see that they were boarding up the windows with what appeared to be the front of cabinets. So I had a sense that there was damage that was happening, and there was really no reason for it. And then as more and more media started covering this situation, they started getting angrier and angrier that their faces were all over the news. And they had one night a destruction party. And so we drove by. We could hear the damage going on inside, call the police. They had no right to go into the property, they told us. And when I finally got the keys back and I could go into my own property, it was completely completely decimated. You could see from one room into another through walls. They had stolen appliances. There was human feces all over the house and maggots. And they did $40,000 worth of intentional damage.
Wow. I'm guessing that the sale that you had in the works was either delayed or, you know, lost entirely.
Yeah, I lost the sale entirely. I had to pull the house off the market while the squatters were in there. And then when they were finally removed, I had to enter into about 8 weeks of complete internal repair of the home that cost me that amount of money. Thank goodness the homeowner's policy did cover it. But I'm sure those costs are all going to be passed down to me in some form or another, and unfortunately others. And so that's another reason that we've really got to fix this problem, because the costs get borne by those that are, you know, trying to do the right thing.
Well, we have a message from Ed on Facebook. He says, what's the penalty to squatters? Any jail or financial penalty? I think that probably brings us, Zach, to what is changing July 1, this new law.
Yeah, so back to the prior question about jailing squatters. There is no automatic jail for squatters in the new law. It's not you get caught squatting, you're going to jail. There are three new crimes that were added, but they're more specific. One is similar to Patty's situation. If you cause more than $1,000 worth of damage to a property you were squatting in, that is now a second-degree felony. There's also a first-degree misdemeanor for fabricating documents to claim you have an interest. So if you create a fake lease or something like that, that's now a misdemeanor. And then there's a first-degree felony, which is intended to address this idea of people renting out properties they don't own or listing for properties they don't own. If you engage in that knowing that you don't have a right to, or you're representing someone that you know doesn't have a right to sell it, that's now a first-degree felony. So those are the criminal provisions that were added based on this law. There's no blanket, you're a squatter, you're going to jail.
And this law, as you said, also gives officers, well, I don't know if you've said it to me, but it gives the officers some discretion. So in Patty's case, they looked at what they thought were faked documents, a fake lease, mm-hmm. but they weren't able to use their judgment and say, you know, we think this is a squatting situation and make an arrest, but now they might.
Yeah, this law... Patty had mentioned this earlier when we were talking before we came on air, that it really shifts the burden. Historically, the burden has been on the property owner proving they're not supposed to be here. And now it shifts the burden to the occupant, to the squatter, to show that they really are allowed to be there. Because essentially what it provides is you can now skip the civil court process and you can file a statement under perjury with the sheriff that says, I'm the owner of the property. It's a residential property. There's somebody in it. I've asked them to leave. They won't leave. They're not a tenant. They're not a family member. Please remove them. And it is the sheriff's obligation to then go and remove that person immediately. You don't wait the 24 hours you used to wait for the writ of possession, which was huge because that's when they would cause a lot of this damage. They'd get served with the writ of possession. They'd have 24 hours to leave, and they'd spend that 24 hours destroying the property. And now, in the situation where someone prevents potentially that fabricated document, the way that I read the statute is the sheriff is to remove them, and then they have a cause of action for wrongful removal. So if they are removed and they do have a legitimate lease, so if a landlord is wanting to use this new squatter law to skip the eviction process, the law covers that too and says, if you're caught and it's wrongful removal, you're going to pay their attorney fees, you're going to pay their costs, and you're going to pay them three times the market rent of the property. So it really shifts that burden. The sheriff gets them out. Then they have their right to go to civil court to prove that they were allowed to stay there, because those are such a small amount of the cases where this happens that's to me a better shift of the responsibility, because so few people have a legitimate right to be there compared to the number who don't.
And again, the removal would really be based on an officer's judgment. So they could look at a situation where a landlord is saying, this person should be removed, and say, well, it's not clear enough to me that this is a squatter, and it would continue through the civil process that Patty had to go through, as opposed to an automatic removal?
The statute isn't entirely clear on that, but the way I read it and the way I think it should be enforced is that the removal is automatic once the owner swears under perjury that this is the case, and then let the civil court decide if it was wrong. So I don't read it as having a ton of discretion in it. If the owner doesn't follow the statutory form and it seems like they're playing games and the occupant can provide a lease, then maybe that's a different scenario. But just this idea that someone presents a document and the sheriff's office is going to say, well, I'm not completely sure. I'm not sure the statute contemplates that anymore.
We had an email from Amy. She said, if the lease is not signed by the homeowner as the lease, how is that legal? And I think we've kind of discussed that in terms of it's just a fake lease, right? It's
My lease wasn't signed. But again, in the current situation, before the law is implemented, the police basically say, I have no ability to evaluate whether this is a valid or an invalid document, signed or unsigned. I just can't make a judgment.
And then John from Facebook, he says squatters should absolutely be incarcerated. If there is no harsh penalty, it will continue. Patty, did you pursue criminal charges in this case? You know who the women are.
I do know who the women are. And I have a pretty good idea that they're still here in Jacksonville. I attempted to pursue criminal charges, but they cannot be found. And it's really low priority on behalf of the sheriff's office. And furthermore, pursuing any sort of charges on the $40,000 would require the state's attorney to get involved, or at least that's what I was told. And they had no appetite for it at the present time. So I'm hoping that with this new law, and Zach, you can weigh in, is that now this whole profile of squatters and cost is raised in the in the state of Florida and amongst the legal and criminal system, and that they will pay more attention to pursuing these kinds of charges.
And to be clear, in your case, you know, police didn't witness these two women damaging your house, and the state attorney's office likely wouldn't have been able to demonstrate with any, you know, any persuasive power that they had actually done the damage themselves, as opposed to somebody else.
Spot on. And that was one of their justifications for not pursuing, is that they couldn't deduce exactly who did the damage. And since there were a variety of people in and out of the house, that made that that case even weaker.
You know, one of the elements of squatting is it's not just the house that's impacted, but very often the neighborhood as well. And it can be sometimes they're used for drug manufacture or prostitution. They really can be a problem for entire neighborhoods. And sometimes it happens on a large scale with more than one home in a neighborhood being taken.
There's a great example in Atlanta that's really dealing with significant squatter issues. And Georgia has now written a bill that is somewhat similar to Florida. And I think it's moving through the Senate side of the legislature now. But in Atlanta, there was an example where there was a neighborhood where they felt like there were 1,000 or more squatters there that had created drug and prostitution rings and strip clubs and other things. And the neighbors in this gated neighborhood had absolutely no power to get rid of them.
Extraordinary. I think that that has actually moved through both sides, and Georgia's just kind of waiting the governor's signature.
Oh, marvelous.
So this law passed with bipartisan support?
100% bipartisan support. And I asked several senators and representatives if they could remember anything in recent history that had passed with that kind of 100% bipartisan support. And they said nothing of a substantive nature that anyone could remember in the recent past. I think it was a really, really great example of the fact that Senator Perry and Representative Steele saw my story on Fox independently, and they both began writing bills for their side of the legislature, heard about each other's bills, came together, and it went through committee. I had the opportunity to testify on both sides. And then there was some reticence from the Democrats in each of the committee. That each of the senator and the representative sat down with every single person on each of those independent committees and heard their issues, as well as in when it was presented on the floor, there were others that spoke against the bill, such as Florida Rising, and their concerns were heard. And as a result, when it went to full vote, there was not a single nay vote.
We got an email from Lisa saying, is the new law in Clay County? Yes, statewide. And Jim from Facebook asking a good question. Can the owner just have the power and the water shut off? Zach?
Well, typically the occupant would have the ability to contact and have the utilities put into their name. Usually utilities aren't in the name of the owner. They're in the name of the occupant. So it's similar if you have a tenant. So they'll probably just call and get it turned on. And JEA or whoever the utility is, isn't in the business of verifying if they're squatters, if they're illegally. So probably it probably wouldn't work.
So also I was told that I did have the power and the water on in my name when I was selling the house. And so I thought, oh, fabulous, I'll just turn it off. When I called JEA to turn it off, they told me, well, the water and electricity had been turned on in the squatter's name. So then I marched it up through JEA to say they don't have a right to be in my house. And they said it's not our place to judge whether or not that's a legitimate renter or owner or not. And then the police told me that if they had not turned it on in their name, then it would be incumbent. I don't know if this is true, Zach, but it would be incumbent on me to provide water and electricity because I can't provide a domicile that doesn't have the basics to live in.
Under Chapter 83, Part 2, which is residential tenancies, there are obligations to provide certain utilities. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you have to have them in your name. It just means that they have to be available at the premises.
Well, it is an extraordinary story, Patty. Amazing that your difficult experience led to such enormous change in the state. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Patty Peoples, Zach Roth, thank you both so much for being here and talking about this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
Up next, Jacksonville's oldest African-American theater stages a performance of The Color Purple.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Ooh, oh, sometimes.
Welcome back. The Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Color Purple, has been made into movies, stage productions, and most recently a musical, and it comes to the local stage this weekend at Jacksonville's historic Black Theater stage Aurora. I'm joined now by two stars of the show, Akia Uwanda and Dee Dee Ellis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Akia, was that you just singing we heard?
It was.
You have a marvelous voice.
Thank you.
Is that your own song?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So Stage Aurora has been around for a long time. It is the longest running active Black theater in Jacksonville.
Yes.
And it has a long history of, you know, bringing stage productions that speak to the African-American community in Jacksonville.
Yes.
How does The Color Purple fit into its overall staging mission and kind of its scheduling priorities? Dee Dee.
Well, Stage Aurora was launched in 2000 with the goal of bringing theater to what was then an underserved community, north side of Jacksonville. And since then, the theater has brought a multitude of different productions here to Jacksonville. It was actually the first theater to present The Color Purple in the state of Florida. So it fits in with the theater's presentation of different cultural pieces in an attempt to share the community with other cultures. So it's a great addition. The theater's done it, the presentation twice, and each time it has been a great success. So we are looking forward to bringing it back to Jacksonville.
And how has the community been served by Stage Aurora? How has that sort of changed the cultural landscape on the north side?
Tremendously. Just the idea of bringing Black theater in different presentations that you would usually see on a much larger main stage in much larger cities here to Jacksonville, Florida, and exposing not only the north side, but all elements of the community to these different productions. It's truly had a significant impact on the local community, bringing the arts here and having others see these presentations done in a different light.
Akia, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this production. This is not your first Stage Aurora production. How did you come into performance and singing?
Like you said, this is our third time now, Dee.
Third time.
And she and I both played Shug Avery the first time years ago, and it was such a great cast and great performance. So this is, I'm a full entertainer, so I do acting, singing, and, hosting and modeling and all those things. So this is just another arm, but I really enjoy doing acting so I can really reach into the community and inspire some others who look forward to doing it as well.
So you've played Suge, both of you, in the past.
Yes.
What is your current role?
I'm going to be a church lady, Darlene. So we're like the narrators. We bring in like a comical feel to narrate this whole story. And Dee is Suge Avery again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. For people who aren't familiar, tell us about Suge's character and what the plot is. It's a very difficult plot on a lot of levels. It's a difficult story.
And I think on the surface, people tend to look at different characters in a negative light in the play. But actually what you find out is all of the characters are seeking love and acceptance. And it's a love and acceptance that has been denied to them by someone or perhaps some community. So even if you're looking at Mister's father, for example, mm-hmm. and he seems very hard and very harsh on Mister, but part of the reason that he's that way is the result of the racism that has been imposed upon him as a former slave. So this hardness, this sort of judgment goes down the line to his son and even to his son. So we see that lack of love, that lack of trust, that lack of support that has affected all of the characters. And in the end, it's Celie, the main character, who by discovering herself impacts that same love and trust on all the other characters and allows them to grow and accept themselves and just become a joy in the production.
Mm-hmm. So, and I have not seen the musical version of this, but of course familiar with the book and the plays. How does it differ in terms of its overall mood, Akia?
Okay, well, the music production, what we're doing this time, we're taking a rendition of the stage production and we're making it a concert benefit performance. So we'll be using visual projections that would transport the audience through 1909 to 1947 visually. And then we're using dynamic singers and dancers and acting and the storyline to really transcend the audience in an emotional state that really is a combination of the film and the Broadway production. So that's what we're doing here. And the music from the original Color Purple movie is so different from the original Broadway play. Even the new Color Purple revised movie that came out last year has different music from both of them. So we're doing the music from the original Broadway play with our own spin, and we'll be doing more a concerta of this performance.
Very cool. Why do you think that this work has such life on so many different platforms?
I think it resonates with people's personal stories. And just as Dee said, it's a story about love, but you also have that resilience, that hope and love that people go through in their own lives. I mean, people suffer from trauma. So to see Celie come from a place of hurt being, you know, stripped away from her family, stripped away, her sister stripped away from her. Her kids are stripped away from her. She thinks they're dead for most of the story. Then she finds out on a mission that her sister has the kids and she's been raising them in Africa. And then in the very end, they're reunited. But between that part and, you know, between the beginning and end, there's a whole slew of sister girls, a whole community of other characters, men that end up coming together to love on one another, to get all of them through. And that's what we experience in real life, right? We experience things, and then because of our community, our village, it makes us a better person and it helps healing. So that's what you'll see in this production as well.
Dee Dee, what are your thoughts about that? Why this has legs on, you know, as a book, as a movie, as a play, as a musical?
Well, beyond what Akia said, I think it just touches us as individuals because we all want that love. We all want that support. We all want that trust, and that's true. But also the songs. The songs are so beautiful and the performances have always been so inspiring. So during our production, we had the privilege of working with Angela Whitehurst, who is from the Jacksonville area, has performed in several television productions.
Movies.
And, yes, mm-hmm. and also played Suge Avery on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So to have her as our mentor and continue to be in our lives, it's just inspiring. So looking at her performance, looking at performances of other actors who have played in these roles, it touches the heart. It always does. So I feel that anyone who comes to see this play or any production, there's no way you can walk away without feeling something.
Yeah. So yeah. Tell us about the production, when it is, how people can attend. It's Saturday, right? Where there's more than one?
Yes. We have two performances at FSCJ, Kent Campus on Roosevelt Boulevard. And there's one performance at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. People can go to www.stageroar.com to get those tickets.
Uh-huh.
Or Brothers 2000 in Gateway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you say that last one?
Brothers 2000 in Gateway Mall area.
Oh, okay, terrific. And so how do you expect the audience to, I don't know, to respond to this particular performance in a way that is different than the prior Color Purple that you've staged?
I think it's going to be a very interesting surprise for them, because of course they're expecting the Color Purple, and of course they're expecting the songs, and they've probably heard them before, but this new way of presenting it, I think, is going to be something that's going to surprise and just energize them. As we mentioned before, the songs, the words touch you, but in this different way of presenting, and we don't want to give away too much because we want it to be a surprise, I think everyone's really going to be affected. They're going to enjoy. It's a new way of looking at the production.
It's kind of really like a multimedia approach that you're doing with the visuals and
acting as well on stage. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's going to be awesome.
It sounds great. What's next for Stage Aurora after this performance? What other shows are going to be coming down the pike this year?
There's more benefit presentations. The founder and owner of the company, Darryl Reuben Hall, he currently resides in New York, but he's actually in his own productions himself. He's mm-hmm. currently in Winter Park doing Five Guys Named Mo. So he's traveling, but he is doing productions and benefits for Stage Aurora everywhere.
How many production, like how many stage events are there typically in a year at Stage Aurora?
Since COVID, there has been the summer camps that have been most visual, and then now this one. But before then, there were several. There are many. Things changed.
So the theater has scaled back since the pandemic.
Yes. Yeah. But like I said, he's doing benefits for and fundraisers for the organization, not in just Jacksonville, but other places as well.
Mm. Well, he's done several productions.
One man shows.
In New York City.
Yeah, virtual also. Presentations.
So there's a Stage Aurora production there also. So he's able to do different trainings and also do a series of presentations there also. So very multifaceted guy. We just love Darryl. Mm-hmm.
Yes, as it still thrives here in Jacksonville, Florida.
Excellent. Well, we're so glad to have you here today, and we look forward to the Stage Aurora, you know, getting also back up to the productions that it was doing pre-pandemic, because it really is a great resource for the community.
So if anybody's listening to have a building that you'd like to donate for Stage Aurora, let us know.
All right.
And we do appreciate the opportunity to be here and hope everyone will come out and join us. It's going to be a magnificent production. Yes. We're looking forward to it.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to have you both here. And thanks for telling us about the upcoming show.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Stick around. We'll be back in just a moment with a look behind the scenes at what happened during a recent elephant root canal.
Sometimes I feel like a moonless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. I sail a long ways from home. I sail a long ways from home. Sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone. I said, sometimes I feel like I'm almost gone.
Crypto is an amazing technology because the transfer is instant. There's no bank to flag the transaction as suspicious, and there's no limits.
And it's led to the rise of a billion-dollar scam called pig butchering. It pulled in one of our former guests who suddenly had threats, the FBI, and Interpol in his life. Hear the story on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Baptist Health is a proud supporter of First Coast Connect. Baptist Health, committed to building a healthier community for all of us. More info at 202-4YOU or baptistjacks.com.
Eric the Architect gets his inspiration from everywhere.
It could be something world-related. It could be about politics or religion or culture or tabloids. Hip-hop is the one, and it's the current events genre of the world.
He's one-third of the influential hip-hop group Flatbush Zombies, and he's out with his first solo album. Rapper and music producer Eric the Architect joins us next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. I'm joined now by the intrepid itinerant Curtis Dvorak, ambassador for the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, whose official title is Wildlife Wanderer.
That's right.
Thanks for wandering on over, Curtis.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I am delighted to have you. And I have to tell people who can't see, last time you were here, I said I would like you to bring a lemur next time.
Yes.
And you did.
I did. I brought you a lemur. The only kind of lemur I can actually bring you.
A stuffed lemur.
Which you also love stuffed animals.
I do. I love stuffed animals, and I'm going to cuddle it while we talk.
It's a lovely gray ring-tailed lemur that I brought you there. And again, but, you know, I wanted down the road get you with Tracy Fenn, our head of mammals, out at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, because she actually runs a lemur rescue
foundation. Yeah, and there's some concerns about people over...
Yeah, they're not pets, folks.
They're not pets,
They're not pets.
Well, we will talk about that, and... you're here to talk about a big event, but I want to get to something first that you witnessed.
It all goes together.
Okay.
Yeah.
So last week, something extraordinary happened at the zoo.
Yes.
And you were there.
Yep. Months, years in planning.
An elephant root canal.
Basically, yeah. Tusk removal. One of Ali's tusks a while back had gotten basically cracked. And what happens when an elephant's tusk gets cracked, it's like a tooth, whatever, infection can get in, and then it starts to, a cavity forms. And so our amazing team out there, you know, there's experts around the world that do these tusk removals when an accident like that happens or a fracture. And so they contacted them. They brought them in last year, tried to get it, could not get it out, but they did basically a root canal then to get the, you know, what they saw as the infection out. And then to come back this year, to try to actually remove the root of that tusk. Because the tusk, if anybody who's seen Ali out there at the zoo over the last several years, you can see both tusks were, you know, were cut. And so this was getting the root of this one out. And experts from around the world, literally South Africa, Asia, the elephant experts from around the world, plus other zookeepers from the States at other zoos came in, had to be 30 plus people around this elephant. To make this happen. And it took the elephant. I was there. I was in that position that I showed you those videos from for 3 hours. It was 3.5 to 4 hours procedure. And when that tusk, I just showed you the last piece coming out, when that thing came out and the crowd, everyone cheering to see, you know, Dr. Meredith, our vet out there at the zoo, to see tears in her eyes after it was complete. And Ali was back up. And it was back up walking around to see tears in her eyes. This was months and years in the making, and to see that happen was absolutely incredible. And you know me, like I thought I was going to be kind of grossed out, but I was locked in, and I just sat back, you know, kind of halo, listening to these conversations. And you had one person over here who was just in charge of the breaths, you know, and they had a breathing tube for Ali, which was like forced air in there. And there was one person just with their hand on his belly, just watching a clock every 20 seconds or so, breath, and then you'd hear that. And then over here you had the anesthesiologist team checking different vitals. And then over here you had fluids. And then here you had all this stuff. And then, by the way, you had the surgeons, the doctors at the front trying to remove, using, you know, power tools and saws.
And brute force in some cases just to pull this thing out.
To get it to dislodge. But happy to say Ali popped back up after they reversed the anesthesia. And then I've been checking on him just about every other day. I go back there and just hang out, and he's doing great. People have seen him on exhibit in the last couple weeks. It was just truly amazing to see one animal. And obviously we had to get this thing out because if you leave it, it can go sepsis, and he's not going to tell you. He's not going to tell you that he has this blood infection and all this stuff. And so you have to get that thing out. And they do this in the wild. They do this out, you know, when it happens out there, you know, to save an animal in the wild. But to see the collection of people come together for this one elephant to make this happen is what exuberation is all about.
So let's talk about that, because this is the biggest fundraiser for the zoo coming up. What is exuberation? When is it?
Exuberation is Friday, 2 days away, April 5th. It is a party at the zoo for 21 and up. So sorry, kids. My kids won't be there. The 5-month-old will be there because my wife is basically a marsupial right now.
That's right.
The baby
She's the walking dairy bar.
The baby doesn't leave the chest there. So my baby will be there. But it's 21 and up party. We have a couple DJs. We have a silent disco. We have a band. We have a silent auction. A bunch of restaurants, 24 vendors, restaurants, local restaurants will be serving up bites and stuff for you. So your ticket includes your food and your drinks, open bars.
And the zoo.
In the zoo, yeah. And you're inside the zoo. You're walking around the zoo. If you get there early, right as it starts, animals will be out until dark. So you'll get to see some of the apes, and you'll see Banks, because it's Banks' first birthday, the baby jaguar.
Oh, yeah.
It's his first birthday celebration.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, we got a whole cake and everything for him. And Jackson DeVille is going to be there to cut the cake for Banks. So that's pretty cool.
Wow. My former doppelganger. You were the former Jackson DeVille, for people who don't know, for 17 years.
My first child, Jackson DeVille.
Yeah. And so there's a lot that happens at this event.
Yes.
But it is also, first and foremost,
it's the biggest fundraiser.
Because the zoo does depend on this kind of money.
100%. We are 501c3. We talked about this last time that, yes, we are, you know, thankful to the city of Jacksonville that gives us some money. But 90%+ of our operating budget we have to raise. And that's through ticket sales to people come, and then obviously ticket sales to events like this. And so the money that's going to be raised on Friday night at Exuberation is what makes the procedure with Ali possible. And it makes everything we do out there possible.
Well, a great reminder of the importance of the zoo, Exuberation, this Friday. Thank you so much for being here, Curtis.
Thanks for having me.
That's our program. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock or find our entire archive at wjct.org or your favorite podcast platform. Join us again tomorrow when we sit down with the reporter behind a new investigation into Republican kingmaker Kent Sturman. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.